Again, good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome back or welcome for the first time to emforum.org, and we are very glad you could join us. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your moderator today. And for our newcomers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. Our topic today is a new course developed by the National Legal Preparedness Project at the University of District Columbia in Washington, D.C. Please note that we do have a number of related handouts that you can download by clicking on the icon of the three overlapping note pages at the top right. And these include a course brochure, a list of locations where the course will be offered in the near future, and an excellent list of legal references with links to the sources. And you can also access these from today's background page later. Now, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with an overview presentation and then proceed to your questions and comments. And we will have a couple of sample questions that you will be able to try out yourself, and it should be obvious what to do when we do get to them. If you have any difficulty with live meeting, you can use the feedback drop-down menu up at the top right to indicate you're having a problem, and then my associates, Ava Jean Moore or Lori Weber, will monitor that and try to assist you via instant messaging. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we do ask you not to submit your questions or comments till we get to that part of the program. And we also ask you not to send any private messages to the speaker or moderator, as we will be busy with the presentation. Now, we are making a live meeting recording and also an audio-only MP3 version, which should be available later today, along with a copy of the slides. And then a text transcript will be posted early next week. Now, if you're not on a mailing list, you can subscribe from our homepage, and you will get a notice when these materials are ready, as well as future program notices. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's guest. Dr. Angeline Flowers is the project director for the National Legal Preparedness Training Program at the University of District Columbia. She's also a professor of criminal justice and director of the university's Homeland Security Graduate Program. And please do see today's background page for additional biographical information and links to the related web resources. Welcome, Angeline. Thank you very much for joining us today. I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Thank you, Amy, and I'm glad to be here. I'd just like to take a couple of seconds to tell everyone a little bit about myself. I have a law degree from Georgetown University Law Center and a PhD in interdisciplinary studies from Commonwealth Open University. I am admitted to the D.C. Bar, the Federal Court of Appeals for D.C., and the U.S. Supreme Court. And in terms of how I sort of fell into this, I have just always had a passion for organizing people in logistics, and it just seemed to fit really well with emergency management and homeland security efforts. This current project, the National Legal Preparedness Training Program, was developed under the auspices of the university's Institute for Public Safety and Justice as part of a cooperative agreement with the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And this was intended to increase the legal preparedness of state, local, and tribal governments. This process has taken a couple of years, and we began with a day-and-a-half focus group that involved over 100 people from around the country. It included frontline emergency responders, emergency managers, lawyers, and judges. And we gathered them all together, and we worked through a scenario that was designed to identify issues that could potentially arise in the event of a disaster. Those issues were refined over a series of months through pilot sessions that were tested across the country, and the end result was this course, Legal Issues and Disasters, Things You Should Know. What I'm going to do for the next few minutes is give an overview of the course, and I'm going to talk about some of the issues that we cover in the training. Now, this is a course on legal preparedness, so the first thing I want to do is talk about legal preparedness, just for background. So legal preparedness has a policy and an operational component. It asks, what is going to be done? Is there some authorizing statute or executive order or legislation that says this is what should be done? The operational component of emergency preparedness is how it's going to be done. Are there rules or regulations or something else that says who does what and how they do it? Now, in addition to all of that, we have two other questions, which is the existing legal authority consistent with protecting individual rights and liberties and protecting due process concerns? And a particular concern for managers is, what are the areas of potential liability and how can they be mitigated? This course focuses on selected legal issues. We, of course, couldn't look at everything. As we all know, tremendous strides have been made over the past few years to increase the nation's readiness to confront an array of threats. The difficulty is that Homeland Security and emergency management, as you know, are constantly changing, presenting new legal issues. Sometimes we have federal authority that's controlling. Sometimes the law can vary from state to state. And so the idea behind this course is to assist the training participants in first identifying the questions so that the development of their responses can be incorporated into their planning process. The goal of the course is to enhance the ability of governments, managers, planners, first responders, and nonprofit organizations to identify potential legal issues. So to accomplish this, we have one background module on planning that looks at issues that kind of transcend the whole process. And then we have four modules where we work through a scenario that unfolds presenting new legal issues. The way we structured the course is to make it extremely interactive. So we have, as I said, the scenario that goes throughout, and then periodically we have case studies that present particular issues for the audience to discuss. And all of this is interspersed with the instructor presentation. So what I want to do is not only identify some of the types of issues that are discussed in the training course, but also give some example of the types of case studies and discussion questions that we use. Just for a little background, we're usually dealing with one of four types of events. We have rapid onset events, which could be something like a tornado. We have isolating events. That could be a pandemic or maybe a hazardous material spill. We have power failure events, which could be temporary or they could be caused by an ice storm or some infrastructure failure. And then we have large-scale events, similar to 9/11, or something like a major hurricane. Now, the first module, as I noted earlier, kind of flows through everything, the issues that arise here. But it is basically a planning module. And so we go through activities that normally take place prior to the event occurring. Planning is a continual process, and plans should be updated after the major event. But a particular concern for legal issues is that it's difficult to address them when they first arise as the event is occurring. And so we really want, as part of this process, to incorporate identification of legal issues into the planning process in advance. Now, we address a series of issues in Module 1. We cover NIMS because that's required in all FEMA training. We look at the whole community concept, which is a recent emergence, and it's been used in reference to including those who are typically overlooked in emergency plans, such as people with limited English proficiency or people with disabilities, as well as people with functional and access needs. We look at the issues that arise with emergency planning and working with tribal governments, as well as issues with the Americans with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. We look at the integration mandate, as well as the integrated public alert and warning system, as well as public alert and warnings for children and adults with disabilities and functional and others with functional access needs, and the particular legal issues that go along with that. An example of the types of issues we discuss in this module is that while many local jurisdictions have memorandums of agreement with neighboring jurisdictions, few of them have MOAs with tribal governments that may be adjacent or overlap their geographic areas. So that's an important concern. The integration mandate basically requires that programs and services be given in integrated settings in terms of the abilities of people, and it has to be inclusive, and their legal issues and liabilities attached to that that we spend some time talking about. Module 2 is where we began our scenario, and this module is an evacuation module. And so it looks at some legal issues and potential liability areas that can arise when governments attempt to evacuate part or all of their communities. Some of the issues that we cover are the authority to order an evacuation. I mean, does the jurisdiction have someone designated who has that authority? And you don't want to find out when the event happens that no one has. Or in one jurisdiction, they changed the person who had the authority, but the law hadn't been finalized yet. Are we looking at a voluntary or a mandatory evacuation, and what are the issues, the liabilities, and duty of care issues that arise with that? What are liability issues related to transportation, both in terms of requirements for transportation and duties that arise once you undertake to transport people? We look at issues with evacuation and pets, as well as issues associated with the refusal to evacuate. Right. Now we come to one of our audience participation questions. So a study by FEMA's Community Preparedness Division found that of the people who indicated that they would need help in evacuating, what percentage said they would need help with transportation? Was it A, 40%, B, 50%, C, 60%, D, 65%, or E, 70%, or who's not voting?
Yeah. All right, we'll give folks a moment. All you have to do is click there by A, B, C, D, or E, and hopefully Angeline will give us the correct answer here as we proceed. We'll give folks a moment to put it in, and when it stops changing, I'll display what the results were. And let's go ahead and put the results up.
Okay, so I see that, well, it looks like they're still changing, but looks like the majority of people thought it was A, 40%. Well, actually, it's 50%. And that has implications, as you can imagine, for the planning process. For instance, legally it means that the plans have to provide or make allowances for public transportation to safe areas and other evacuation help for people who need it. All transportation has to be accessible. for wheelchairs. In addition, all the information about the evacuation and transportation has to be accessible to everyone. But as we can imagine, addressing these issues creates or can create another set of liability questions. One of the other things we can look at is why people refuse to evacuate. Now, if we notice, the Harvard School of Public Health found that a third of people refused to evacuate because they didn't want to leave their pets. That problem has now been addressed through the Pets Evacuation and Transportation Standards Act, or the PETS Act, which requires that emergency planning has to take into account transportation and shelter for household pets. So this is another legal requirement, so to speak. I wanted to share an example of a case study, one of the case studies that we use. So in this case study, a bus company was under contract to evacuate residents, and they supplied buses that were not wheelchair accessible. Several people with disabilities were killed or seriously injured waiting to evacuate. And so then what we would do is discuss with the participants so they could identify with us some of the issues involved. So, for instance, we know that now all transportation has to be wheelchair accessible. So we talked about steps the jurisdiction could take to minimize their liability and simultaneously enhance the safety of their residents. Module 3 talks about shelters. So, some people have evacuated. We have other people in the scenario in emergency shelters. So in this module, we look at some of the legal issues and potential liability areas that can rise for government units or nonprofit organizations that are attempting to provide emergency shelter. In Module 3, the legal issues we look at include shelter accessibility, the requirements for functional needs support services, the requirements for household animals, service animals. We look at discrimination in emergency shelters, as well as infectious disease and social distancing. For instance, general population shelters must be able to accommodate persons with disabilities and persons with access and functional needs. Service animals must be commingled in the shelters. Household pets are to be co-located. And we talk about the differences. But also we identify some issues that might not have arisen in some jurisdictions, and it's important to think about before it happens. So, for instance, how many jurisdictions have guidelines regarding what general population shelter providers should do if a registered sex offender shows up at their shelter? Now, that could be a problem. Okay. All right, this leads us to another question. And remember, we're still in shelters, and that's the context for this question. Now, during an infectious outbreak, what distance from others does the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend? A, 1 foot, B, 2 feet, C, 3 feet, D, 4 feet, E, 5 feet. Okay, it looks like most people said 5 feet. But the answer actually is 3 feet. Now, the question in terms of planning is, what does this requirement mean when people are still in emergency shelters? How do shelters maintain this type of distance in conditions that are sometimes crowded? And what are the liability issues if someone contracts an infectious disease? You know, let's say there is an pandemic influenza going around, and they contract that while in the shelter. I also briefly want to touch on service animals and shelters. Now, service animals are co-located with their owners, which means, service animals are co-mingled. They are actually in the shelter itself with the owners. Now, what issues does that present for someone else in the shelter who has animal allergies? Okay, those are the types of things that seem like small issues, but they're potential liability issues that shelter owners, managers need to have already thought up so they have a plan to address. Now, in the scenario that we're using, as the hurricane unfolded and went away, an outbreak of pneumonic plague broke out, which was the reason for the infectious disease. But now we have lots of very ill people. And so we have an influx in the scenario of out-of-state volunteers. And so, I mean, as all emergency managers know, volunteers are wonderful, but managing large numbers of volunteers can be problematic. So in addition to volunteers sent in response to mutual aid agreements like EMAC or organizations that have contractual agreements to provide services, oftentimes spontaneous volunteers who are unaffiliated with a government entity or an organization show up to help. And Module 4 talks about the issues and liabilities presented when that happens. So FEMA's Citizen Corps Volunteer Liability Guide is an excellent resource. And what we cover in this module are the different types of volunteers, which then affects the type of liability. And we also talk about examples of liability protection. Liability, it can be civil liability. It can be resulting from person operating who is not properly licensed or doesn't have the proper credentials. It can be injury or death to a volunteer, for instance. Liability sometimes can result against an individual or against the organization that was using the individual. The issues that we talked about in Module 4 are the types of volunteers, the different types of liability, the examples of liability protection, and the different sources of those protections. And the final module we talk about, because now we're down to the end of the scenario, and now once past the immediate disaster and issues dealing with that, we now have the issue of how do we pay for this. So Module 5 is federal financial assistance and reimbursement. So basically we're talking about the Stafford Act. And of the three categories, we focus on public assistance, and which includes debris removal, mass care, critical infrastructure. There are legal issues with the repair, restoration, replacement of damaged facilities, as well as others. The area we focus on for the purpose of the scenario is actually debris management. And so the issues we cover in this module are the disaster declaration process, the types of financial assistance, eligibility under the Stafford Act, eligible and ineligible debris removal on private property, permissible and prohibited contracts, and common reasons for FEMA claim rejection. And many of those reasons can be avoided if they are addressed prior to the onset of a disaster. Okay. That actually brings me to the conclusion of my overview. I have the names of the project staff listed, and the course is currently available. It's been certified by FEMA, and it's available in states where the SAA has given approval. The FEMA course number is MGT-36, and the email contact is drobinson@udc.edu. She is handling our schedule. And I thank you for the opportunity to talk with you about the program, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Angela. I appreciate it. Before I turn it over to our audience for the Q&A, would you just clarify just a little bit that I believe your funding is making available this course, that you're reaching out to the state administrative agencies to schedule this course at no cost to them. Is that correct?
Yes. FEMA has provided us funding through September 30th of 2012, and we will come and deliver the course free of charge. Also, if you are a tribal nation, we don't require SAA approval.
Okay, and again, in the handouts is a list of the courses that are currently scheduled to be delivered. However, that, you know, will be expanded as they get responses from the various states. And, Angela, are you going to post basically this course schedule on your website ultimately?
Yes, we will.
Yeah, so, folks, the link to the website is on our background page, and that will be a good place to check back for updates.
Yeah.
Okay, now.
Or just email any of us,
okay,
and, you know, we'll be happy to give you the information.
And for those state folks out there, you are welcome to contact Dr. Robinson at this email address or phone number to schedule, correct?
Yes.
All right. Now, let's move on to our Q&A. And in order to submit a question or make a comment, you just click on Q&A at the top menu, then you'll type it in the top half of the box that opens up. Now, there is a little hand-raising feature there, but we do not use that. When you do click on Ask, your comment will go to an administration panel that I will monitor, and I will announce who the question is from. And I will read the question out loud over the bridge here, and then our guest will respond via the bridge. And then I'll also type in a little text, OK, which will release the text of the question to that Q&A panel. Now, because of the way live meeting works, you are only able to submit one question or comment at a time. Please do keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. And I'm sure while Dr. Flowers cannot give you legal advice on specific cases, she may be able to address your issues in a general way, at least. Correct?
That's correct.
Yes. Okay. We are ready to begin now, so you may enter your comment or question at any time. And we have several available. I'm going to start with Bill Nicholson and just say that he has got a new book on emergency response and emergency management law, they are going to, it's going to be published, an update of that published in the next few months. I'm just going to type in okay, Bill, for folks to be able to read your full description there. Okay. Deborah Buff asks, again, what is the length of the course? It's a one-day course. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Very good. Oops, I had that two questions on that.
Oh, excuse me. Could I just let the audience know that Bill Nicholson was one of the participants in that initial focus group we held?
Excellent. Great. Okay, I have a question from Ari Shine, who says, where do you see the current stream of ADA-based shelter lawsuits going in terms of guidance and best practices?
That direction and the trend seems to be towards full inclusion. And so best practices are that jurisdictions need to move in the direct, jurisdictions are required that their general population shelters accommodate people with disabilities. And that's the direction.
Okay. Okay, I have a question for Guy, from Guy Corriveau. And folks, if I butcher your name, I apologize. He says, in one of your first modules, you speak to the important issues of statutes and other legislative guidance. I wonder how much time you spent on germane acts and regulations, i.e. the Clery Act. I don't know what that is, but hopefully you do.
Okay. In the training, in the different modules, we actually do spend substantial time on the federal acts that apply to everyone. And then some issues, they really are governed by state law. And so we talk about with those the different things that jurisdictions would want to consider. But in the training itself, we do spend time on the relevant federal acts.
Okay, very good. I have a question from Isabel, who's in Canada, Isabel McCurdy. And she's asking about, can international individuals take the course? But this would depend on where you scheduled and where it's going to be offered, because it is an in-person course.
It's an in-person course, and we're funded to offer it to all of the U.S. states and territories. So if there was a training near you and you could cross the border, that would be fine. But we aren't funded to deliver in Canada.
Right. Okay, a question from Dr. Jacqueline McBride, who asks, what are some of the liability issues and concerns in relationship to plan development or lack thereof, integration and sheltering to address human trafficking and violence against women and girls or children in the aftermath of a disaster, catastrophic event, and terrorist incident? Are they addressed in this course?
They are touched on, but to be perfectly honest, they would require a full course in and of themselves, particularly the violence and trafficking. We spend a substantial amount of time talking about integration issues and what's required. And part of that is really looking at children and their unique needs as well as others who have needs that have to be addressed. Like I say, we spend a lot of time talking about integration and the liability issues for jurisdictions for not complying with a lot of the new mandates. But violence and trafficking actually would be a course by itself.
Right. Okay. I have a question from Stephen Kay. Now, he's going to ask a FEMA policy question, which I don't think you can address, but however you can best respond to this, Amberlyn. He says, local municipalities often present legal obstacles for volunteerism, early response, credentialing, et cetera. What is FEMA doing to help work with states and municipality legal departments to implement Good Samaritan protections and standardized approaches to disasters?
Yes, that is a FEMA policy question that I can answer, but what I can say is that states have the ability to do some of this for themselves. For instance, there are several model and uniform acts that cover cross-licensing of individuals who register in advance that if states adopt, then they have that in place.
And I think NEMA is a resource for some of this material, isn't it?
NEMA is... if they're government employees, they're covered under EMAC, but there's a larger issue with people, say, who are not government employees, you know, who come and want to help. So they are covered. There's a Federal Volunteer Protection Act that has some coverage, but then there's also the Uniform Emergency Health Practitioners Act, which was promulgated by the Uniform Law Commission, which... if states adopt, it has a system where health practitioners pre-register, and then they can go and perform in states that have also signed the agreement. And I think as of last November, 12 states had signed that agreement, well, had adopted various aspects of it.
Yeah.
And see, that's separate from EMAC, which NEMA has, because it covers non-government employees.
Very good. Okay, Guy Carvel has another question, and he asks, what types of incidents are the basis for the most litigated cases? Are there some general percentages that you can give?
It really varies. Because the incidents, I mean, the different types of things that happen. So, for instance, a third of the people who are killed, a third of the volunteers who are killed, of the 50% of the people most likely to be killed, a third of those are volunteer firefighters. So, you know, you can have liability there. A lot of the newer liability is coming over the inclusion mandates and failures of jurisdictions to meet those.
All righty. I have a question from Richard Yazbek who says, are you going to rely solely upon your own cadre of instructors who will travel around the country, or will you be seeking assistance in teaching the course for various regions?
What we're trying to do is develop a cadre of instructors from different regions so that after this is over, there is a regional resource. So we do require that they be lawyers, but if you are interested, if you email Deborah Robinson at drobinson@udc.edu, and she will get back to you to follow up on your interest, if that answers the question.
Okay. I have a question from Ava Jean, and she asks, are there performance measures, evaluations that will determine the continued training and potential updates to the course after this fiscal year?
Well, as I said earlier, we're funded through the end of September 30th. We evaluate each training session. There are a series of FEMA-mandated evaluations that are done, that the participants do, to assess the training. Performance measures are the number of deliveries and our ability to actually reach out to all the different jurisdictions. In terms of future funding, that is probably up in the air.
As with most of our funding.
Yeah, I mean, we would be happy to be funded to continue it because there is we're getting a lot of interest. There's a lot of need. And so it's questionable that we can actually get to everyone before September 30th.
Right. I was going to say, any states that are out there, hurry up. Get that. And I want to follow on Ava Jean's question, which is when you develop the course, I presume that you piloted it with some folks in the practitioner community, and if so, what kind of feedback did you get from them?
Yes, we did pilot it with people in the practitioner community, and each time we piloted it, it resulted in significant revamping of the course in terms of the issues that were addressed. The overriding feedback we got was that they felt that there was a need for this type of training. And then the other feedback we got is that there were so many issues that people wanted to have addressed that it was beginning to make the training too long. We could have spent a week and still not addressed all the issues. So we really worked with the practitioners in the pilot sessions in terms of narrowing down the issues that would be addressed.
Gotcha. Yeah, I could see where this could be a week more. Well, we're getting down to the end of our queue here. Other folks have particular issues of concern. Please go ahead and put them in. Jean asks, no last name here, what sort of outreach are you doing to inform jurisdictions that this course is available, especially for the tribal government?
Well, what we have done is we are in the process of reaching out to the SAA in each jurisdiction, and then if they approve the course, they are letting all of their local jurisdictions know. In addition, we are reaching out to the tribal governments because, as I indicated, they don't require SAA approval. And we also are letting volunteer organizations know about it and just generally trying to spread the word. So in those areas where the SAA has not approved it and people want the training, they can let their SAA know.
Right. And this, wouldn't you say this really is, it's not just for emergency managers, this really is a multidisciplinary type of focus since you seem to cover some of these public health issues?
Yeah, it is multidisciplinary. You know, it could include not just emergency managers, but, you know, the frontline responders, nonprofit organizations who provide shelters or health care. And actually, in response to an earlier question, that was the biggest issue, was having enough for each of the different groups without having too much that only would apply to one group and then others would be uninterested. So, yeah, we're trying to reach a broad group of people.
Right. So, I mean, we have our, what is it, our ESFA, which is, I think that's the health and medical one. It's been a while since I've looked at those, but if the course is being offered in your area, you would be encouraged to bring those kind of people. So, okay. Carlos Garcia says, the state of Indiana has developed a course that we have provided to our emergency management directors and staff over the last 10 years. The course is very Indiana-specific. Will your course also incorporate a state flavor or provide relevant information to the state where it may be provided? And I had a similar question. You know, you said you helped, you know, at least identify the questions that need to ask, but do you provide some assistance in terms of, you know, telling folks where to go look for the answers?
Well, one of the things that we're not permitted to do is anything that actually sounds like we're giving legal advice. So we help them identify questions. I mean, we can generally say, you know, you might want to talk to this person or go look at a particular statute, but that would be the limitation, what we could do in terms of specific state-oriented information. But the other thing we're finding about this is on the issues that are really dependent on state law, some states have addressed them and some states haven't. Or in some instances, it's really like local cities and counties that haven't addressed them. And so it's helpful for them in a large group of people to hear how other people have addressed that issue. So they can then take it back to their decision makers or policy makers and say, you know, we need to look at this.
Do you provide any recommendations as to how to actually incorporate these issues into planning documents?
In terms of writing the actual planning document itself, no. But what we do is we are fairly specific in terms of what the requirements are.
Okay.
And so hopefully people will be able to take that and then incorporate it into their planning documents.
Yeah, and I'd be interested in getting any feedback from our audience members who have done this. I know in some states there may be an actual legal annex to a local plan or perhaps even a state plan. So, if you've had experience in this area, please let us know what you did. And, oh, by the way, Bill Nicholson says he helped write that Indiana course. Graham. Okay, I got another one from Ava Jean, and G asks, who has the loudest voice regarding legal issues as a result of this disaster experience, local, state, or federal level? And I'm not sure if she may be asking also, you know, when suits are showing up, are they showing up at the local level, the state level, and the federal level?
They are showing up. I mean, ultimately, as we know, all disasters are local. And so they are showing up, generally suing a local jurisdiction, but oftentimes they're suing them for violation of a federal law.
Gotcha. Okay, well, we're just about coming to our the end of our queue. Don't have any more questions in the queue. I'll give it just a moment more, and if we do not have any more, then we'll just go ahead and wrap up a little bit early, going once. All right. Okay, let's go ahead then and wrap it up today. And on behalf of Ava Jean and myself and all participants today, we want to thank you very much, Angeline, for taking time to share this information with us. And we wish you every success as you move forward on the next stage of this project with the field delivery.
Well, thank you so much. And as I said earlier, if anyone is interested in having a delivery or interested in acquiring about being a trainer, please don't hesitate to contact us.
Yes, and I did want to mention also a thanks to the executive director, Dr. Deborah Robinson, for her assistance with preparing for today's program.
Yes.
Okay, before you run off, folks, please take a moment to complete our little feedback form, and if there's any other additional comments you want to get in, this is the way to do it. As a reminder, we are hosting a special event tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, Crisis Response and Disaster Resilience 2030, with David Kaufman, Director of FEMA's Office of Policy and Program Analysis. And this program looks forward to the future challenges that we may face in emergency management. So we hope you can make the time to join us tomorrow. And we will put a reminder out about that one on our list later today. Then our next regular program will take place Wednesday, February 8th. Please mark your calendars and watch for announcements. Again, if you're not on our mailing list, you can go to our homepage, and there is a place to subscribe, and then you will get a message when today's materials are ready, as well as future program announcements. Thanks to everyone for participating today. Have a great afternoon. We are adjourned.